Howdy, howdy there. This is Muscle for Life, and I am your host, Mike Matthews. Thank you for joining me today for a new episode on troubleshooting weight loss. So if you are cutting and you feel like you are doing at least the most important things, mostly right, most of the time, but you're not seeing progress, this episode is going to help you. And if you are not currently cutting, but you have experienced that in the past, and you never got it fully resolved, you never got it fully figured out, maybe you actually reached your body composition goal through a brute force, maybe by dramatically increasing exercise or dramatically decreasing calories. If the period of plateau that you experienced left you a little bit puzzled and a little bit unsure of what else you could possibly do in the future if you were to experience something like that again, then this episode is for you as well. And if you've never experienced a weight loss plateau and you are going to stick with this fitness thing for a while, this episode is for you too, because you will. Eventually, everybody experiences weight loss plateaus. And they can be mysterious. And so all of that broadly is what you are going to be learning about in today's episode. It's going to be a practical focus on troubleshooting the most common mistakes that people unwittingly make when cutting, the most common obstacles that prevent people from achieving their fat loss goals. And you are going to be hearing mostly from my guest, Harry Barnes, who not only has over 10 years of coaching experience helping people break through fat loss plateaus, but he's also the head of coaching for my sports nutrition company, Legion's one-on-one coaching program. And he's been in that position since we launched it back in 2015. And he helps run a team of nearly 20 coaches that have worked now with thousands of people of all ages, all circumstances, many different preferences, many different goals. We've seen a lot over the years, and Harry has been there in the trenches the entire time. And so, as you will see in this episode, Harry not only has a good understanding of the science of weight loss, he also understands the art of it. By that, I mean the practicalities. He has a very pragmatic perspective and approach, because sometimes what is theoretically optimal, which you could find in research, is practically suboptimal because, for example, someone you're working with is not going to be able to stick to that theoretically optimal approach. And so you have to be able to find the right balance of compromises that allow that person to actually reach their goal. And then that person's basket of compromises may not work for the next person that you are working with. For that person, you have to tweak the dials in different ways, and so on and so on. And again, Harry has been doing this for a long time. And in this episode, he is going to share some of the biggest insights he has learned along the way.
Before we get started, how would you like a free meal planning tool that figures out your calories, your macros, even your micros, and then allows you to create 100% custom meal plans for cutting, lean gaining, or maintaining in under 5 minutes? Well, all you got to do is go to buylegion.com/mealplan, buylegion.com/mealplan, and download the tool. And if I may say, this tool really is fantastic. My team and I spent over 6 months on this thing working with an Excel wizard, and inferior versions of this are often sold for $50, $60, even $100. Or you have to download an app and pay every month, or sign up for a weight loss service and pay every month $10, $20, $40, $50, even $60 a month for what is essentially in this free tool. So if you are struggling to improve your body composition, if you are struggling to lose fat or gain muscle, the right meal plan can change everything. Dieting can go from feeling like running in the sand in a sandstorm to riding a bike on a breezy day down a hill. So again, if you want my free meal planning tool, go to buylegion.com/meal plan, buylegion.com/meal plan, enter your email address, and you will get instant access.
Hey, Harry, thanks for taking some time to come and talk with me and the listeners.
Yeah, no problem. How's it going?
Pretty good. Is this our first interview, I think, right?
Yeah. So I know, obviously, chatted between, but I don't think we've, you know, kind of formally sat down and gone through.
Formal interview. I mean, we've talked about many things over the years, but formal interview. Well, cool. I'm glad that I think Army brought this up. Mm. So thanks to Army for the idea. Because when you brought it up, I was, that is a good idea. One, having you on the podcast is a good idea. And two, this is a good idea for the topic. So I'm looking forward to getting into it. And for people listening, the topic is going to be, I guess you could say broadly, troubleshooting fat loss. So let me just give kind of the circumstances, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, Harry. So
Let's talk to people
who generally know what they're supposed to do. They understand energy balance. They understand macronutrient balance. They don't have any delusions about what it takes to lose fat, and they are dieting. They're trying to lose fat. Maybe they've had some success, and then now they're not. Or maybe this is in the beginning and they haven't really even been able to achieve much success yet, despite they think doing what they're supposed to do. So they believe that they are maintaining a consistent calorie deficit ultimately, one way or another, however they're going about it. They think that they're doing what they need to do to accomplish that, yet they're not getting the results that they want. How do you go about troubleshooting this with clients? Because you see this regularly in your work, and you've seen it, I'm guessing, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times over the years. Yeah, or thousands. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so pretty much everyone, especially when it comes to fat loss, pretty much everyone who comes into the coaching service or chats you one-to-one, when you look at their typical week, typical month, there's probably one or two big things that's usually holding them back. Something very specific, like the stress eating after work a few times per week. So the main things before, like, it is important, of course, to go through like good program design, make sure they understand, you know, how energy balance works, getting those lifting plan in place, daily activity. But once that's set in place, which is, you know, people can do quite straightforwardly with the blog and the books and so forth, it's then going to be looking at like the main couple of things that are tripping them up and kind of working backwards from them. So if, for instance, someone is, let's say, stress eating after work 2 or 3 days per week, and it's quite significant enough where, you know, it's putting them a couple of thousand calories in excess 2, 3, 4 days a week, I would look at something like that and think that's going to be the biggest ROI for this person. If they can get that in check and their goal is to lose 30 pounds, they might get 20, 25 pounds of that off just getting that one thing in place. And working, once you've identified what that one thing is or two things, then usually working upstream. So if someone gets through, you can almost imagine in real time, if you put yourself in the position of that person's position, they would walk through the door, stress eat for however long and not feel great, and then probably rinse your feet a few times a week. So we'd look at that instance as, hey, I'm overeating pretty dramatically at 6 p.m. a couple of times a week. What's happening the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours leading up to that? And then it's going to be looking at it in detail, probably more detail than they may be comfortable asking themselves at first, and reflecting on it. And it might be things like, I'm, you know, not setting any boundaries at work and work through my dinner break, and then just grazing on crappy food that's brought into the office through the afternoon, and then driving home in traffic, and I could probably do with maybe sitting and giving myself a 10-minute breather before I commute home. And it's those kind of one-of-one solutions that it's very tough for people to find on blogs and in books. And there's not going to be, you know, an article perfectly.
There's no SEO value in that article, so no one's writing the article.
Yeah, it's hard to like package that up for someone. Like, how do you create that kind of curated one-of-one solution? Like, it's really, and that's where kind of like thinking frameworks and problem-solving tools come in place, where it's kind of like the unsexy stuff that no one's going to Google problem-solving frameworks for not overeating after work 3 days a week. Like, that article doesn't exist, but that's where that person will find results. Like, if they can fix that, that could be the thing that they've struggled with for a decade and then allows them to get the weight off. And it's usually those kind of those kind of solutions that is what also has been missing. Like the, it reminds me of the kind of short pitch that you put for the coaching on some of the podcast episodes, where it's like, hey, you know, imagine the passcode you've got your computer and one of the digits is missing. That missing digit isn't, it might be something obvious, like I'm not eating enough protein, but it is usually something not obvious, like how do I fix the stress eating I've been struggling with for a long time.
Yeah, and just for people listening, if you're not familiar with the analogy, it's the password on your computer, right? You have to get it exactly right to get access to the computer. If you have one extra space, or if it's lowercase instead of uppercase, or vice versa, it's one, maybe one character out of 12 or 14 or however many characters are in your password, and yet it's a binary result, fail. It's not, well, okay, you'll get access to most of the computer, but not all of it. It's no, you know, you're just denied access. So similarly, especially in weight loss and in fat loss, it can be very binary, where you're doing the most important things. You're doing most of them well, but there's this one thing that you're really not doing well enough. And unfortunately, that one mistake is enough to deny you access to consistent fat loss.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other skills that, again, I've not really seen this anywhere, but it's maybe just intuition from working with so many people, is kind of the almost looking for like all those skills across a given week, like all the skills someone needs of like good organization, good problem solving, like how to be in tune with how much stress you can tolerate, like all these not obvious skills that make or break someone's results. Like as you start digging into this process and looking at where people are screwing up and like what's stopping them from getting the results, they might be sometimes those uncomfortable conversations and realizations where, oh, I am only a 2 out of 10 at managing my stress. And like getting that in place first, identifying it and seeing what it's going to take to get to a 3 out of 10, a 4 out of 10, a 5, is it's just not obvious where the solutions are to people. But once you find it and start to get a better understanding of where your skill set is lacking, and then it becomes clearer what the next step's going to be.
And not to make this a thinly veiled pitch for the coaching service, but this is one of the big, I would say, probably actually one of the biggest areas of value in, it could be our coaching or any coaching that is a high quality coaching service. It's not giving you a meal plan to follow. Like, that's fine, that's good. But like you mentioned, or somebody could just, I'd go to our website and just read a blog article too and make a meal plan for themselves. They could even take that diet quiz you put together, and it gets them probably at least 50% there to just having a meal plan. Same thing with a training plan. Yes, that's important. It's what does it take in terms of non-obvious habits that often tie into attitudes and beliefs and other kind of subjective psychological emotional elements that come into play that determine whether you can succeed with any meal plan, even the best meal plan that on paper you love. It checks every box for you, and the training plan on paper you love. But as you mentioned, I think this is just a point worth emphasizing, is that to be able to put it all together and to be able to consistently do all of the tasks that culminate in successfully following a meal plan. It doesn't mean perfectly, but successfully, and successfully following a training plan, it encompasses, I think, quite a bit more than many people realize if they're new to everything that we're talking about. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and also some of the things you mentioned, that it reminds me of like almost how you might approach like writing on user experience, where you've got someone who, whether they're new or experienced, because even experienced people have fallen some of these traps as well. It's just a more like intelligently put together on and off approach that they might fall into. But like if you've got a client where I'm trying to figure out what they're struggling with and what's stopping them from getting results, I would start really broad and just get it in on paper, you know, realistically. Starting with behavior side, like how often can you train? Like how much time do you have to prepare food? What does an ideal meal plan look like on paper? What does an ideal training routine look like? This is usually the first question I speak to people about on their intro call when I'm working with them, is, you know, a year from now, what does your ideal routine look like day to day? Because, you know, we can set the it's kind of like the main point in the start of Atomic Habits. Winners and losers have the same goals. The goal is kind of, that doesn't get us there. It's figuring out like what you can actually sustain day to day and what it's going to look. So yeah, with a client, I look at their entire routine, what we've got. A good idea, like a rough draft based on what they told me, get a rough draft in place. And then during the first couple of weeks, almost again, from like a user experience approach, look at it, just every facet of it. Like how is, you know, say they're going to the gym 4 days a week. How are they feeling after each workout? Which exercises are they enjoying more than others? Which ones don't feel comfortable? Are they enjoying training at that time of day? Just going through all these things which are going to make it stick long term. There's a client I had recently where he was doing, and it's kind of a good example of someone who falls into, it was almost like an intelligently planned on-off approach where he's kind of struggled with the same, say, 20-pound weight loss and weight gain cycle for a long time. And he had a really good routine in place on paper and everything looked great. But a small shift from, say, 3 or 4 really taxing free-weight exercises every day to 1 or 2 free-weight exercises and a couple of machine exercises, he suddenly felt like half the stress when he left the gym. And it was just that reflection of like, where is the stress coming from? What's causing you to feel fatigued at the end of the day? And it was just going through each of those variables of his routine, his diet, even outside of that as well, like work stress. Is he, again, setting little breaks through the day? Is there any, not to get outside of scope, I'm going to start talking about relationship issues, of course, but just seeing if there's any big picture stuff that's going on where it's like screwing up his sleep or his recovery. And again, just slowly reversing them and putting the building blocks in place to get the habits that are going to lead to that ideal routine in 12 months' time. It's going to sustain the 20-pound loss as opposed to follow a really well laid out plan. Ignore some of those subtle issues like, yeah, it's actually a little bit too stressful. And then it's not going to be a crash diet per se. That's a kind of effect that's going to happen. But it's like that effect to stretch out over several months where it's slowly going to fall off again. And then slowly come back on board. So again, it's not obvious, but trying to just have a lot of good reframes and ask a lot of good questions about every part of the process as we go. Before I forget, you mentioned about meal planning as well. Again, someone have a good meal plan in place. And some of the questions we may ask them is to get them away from looking at it as the goal is to stick to the meal plan. It's like we'd ask them questions of like, how are you enjoying each meal? Which ones do you need more variety? And then we can get to the habits which are going to stick like that. I kind of have the same breakfast every day forever. I need 3 options for lunch. I need 5 options for dinner. And just make sure that, again, kind of asking themselves the right questions and focusing on the right things as to go about the process.
And just to bring this back to, again, this theme of troubleshooting and just speaking to people listening who may be stuck in a weight loss plateau. And if they haven't experienced this yet, listener, you will at some point. If you do this long enough, and if you go through periods of, let's say, lean bulking and cutting because you're building up your physique, and now if you're just going to maintain forever, then no, you're fine. But if you're gonna go through at least several rounds of losing a significant amount of fat, inevitably you will run into weight loss plateaus. And so the first thing you mentioned was stress eating as just in your experience working with a lot of people as a common obstacle that is a good example of something that, in a relatively small amount of time, unfortunately, from a fat loss perspective, you can undo all of your good work throughout all the rest of the week. And it's kind of obnoxious that it's true, but it just is that way. You know, you're so good all week and you're sticking to your plan. And in what is cumulatively, maybe it's 30 minutes. Maybe that's the time it takes throughout the week, right? So you have like three episodes of you come home and you eat some stuff that maybe it was not on your plan and it put you into a surplus and it was 5 or 10 minutes per session, so to speak. So in the 15 to max 30 minutes a week, you've completely negated your fat loss for the week. And I'm assuming that stress drinking is another one, especially with calorically dense, like maybe wine.
Yeah, it can be.
If not, I mean, again, I'm deferring to you here. I'm just thinking with things that I've heard many times over the years where it's, you know, it's like a joke now where I'll tell people just sometimes in the gym, you know, you get to know people. And I can think in particular one guy who wants to lose weight and he asking me, should I do keto? Should I do this or that? Right. And in the end, I'm like, you know, unfortunately, it's gonna mean giving up the wine every day. That's realistic, because I mean he was drinking way too much. I was like, you're gonna have to cut that way back. And I know that's what you don't want to hear, but unfortunately, there's really no way around it.
So yeah, that's a good example of, again, where it can be case by case. There'll be plenty of people who they can just stop and start it, okay, and then other people where you're clients who do get say 10% leaned and they can't diligently just have 100 calories of wine with the dinner each night. So it's very case by case. And again, asking them what it looks like long term. And then as we go about those changes, like if that guy, for example, was having, let's say, 4 glasses of wine several nights a week.
Yes, correct. You know, it cannot just be like, you know, one serving.
Yeah.
Maybe not every day, maybe every other day. No, it needs to be like a bottle a day or something.
Yeah. There's the two things that come to mind are, with whatever, you know, whether it's alcohol or overeating on the weekend, whatever it is, the kind of 5 whys approach, which is like an asking tool, is in a lot of like coaching courses and so on, where when a client presents them like that, it's like, oh, why is that happening? Oh, tell me more about that. Why is the root cause of that happening? And then that's when a few of those layers down, you start to get to, yeah, like I actually freaking hate all my coworkers and I'm just 10 out of 10 stressed at the end of the day. It's like, ah. Now we're getting some words, like see where some of the adjustments can be.
And practically speaking, how do you make some of those adjustments? Because too much stress is a very common problem. I'm sure a lot of people listening are dealing with this, even if they're not dealing with a weight loss plateau. So practically speaking, how do you help people mitigate that? Because that's a good example. Okay, it's my coworkers that are giving me all these problems, or maybe it's going through a rough time with a significant other, or point being, it's not like it's just a lever you can pull. Okay, we'll just turn that off. Just stop interacting with your coworkers or your significant other, and then you're fine. Yeah, there you go. And then you're fine. And you'll stop stress eating and you'll get lean.
Yes. Again, it is case by case. A lot of the start of that conversation would be certain clarifying questions, like exploratory questions, seeing what solutions they've found useful in the past, seeing what maybe just strikes them as gut instincts, like, ah, this would be an obvious solution. Like, there are various options in terms of like where they're located in the office, things like that. And then once people brainstormed on a few solutions, pulling them down, going through them, and maybe, you know, trimming it down to the 1, 2, 3 solutions that they kind of most want towards. And then if needed, breaking those down a little bit finer until they feel like, yep, that change is the one of those 3 options that feels the most realistic. And, you know, I'm in 8, 9, 10 out of 10 confident I can make that happen. And then from there, it would be get that adjustment in place, give it a week, 10 days, whatever the time frame makes sense to review it for, and see how it sticks. And whether it kind of goes both ways, whether it's building a positive habit for someone brand new or trimming away a negative influx, the same thing is just looking at breaking it down smaller and smaller and smaller until it feels like a 10 out of 10 doable task. And then you've almost got the thin end of the wedge, and then you know what the thick end of the wedge looks like. Might be no drinking. The thin end might be 3 glasses instead of 4 glasses a day. And then it's like 2.5 glasses, 2, 1.5, 1. And just working it up with a frequency and readiness and willingness the client is wanting to do.
So that's stress calories, let's say. And so let's say that's not the issue. Again, we're stuck on a weight loss or in a weight loss plateau, and we're trying to troubleshoot here, and it's not stress calories. What's another common, if we were to view this as a flow chart, basically? Okay, no, it's not that. Where does this lead to next commonly?
Yeah, so the kind of main 3 steps, like that process, if I'm chatting to a client who agreed that, yes, it's going to be a plateau, the main thing is the first step would be address consistency and accuracy across the board with everything. Starts with the more obvious and go into the more subtle things. So the obvious ones would be weekdays versus weekends. Are you using a food scale or reliably using like portions of a total packet when you weigh out meals? Are you tracking condiments, coffees, butters, oils, all those things? Is there any day-to-day differences in terms of how consistent you are with those measuring tools? And then maybe a little less obvious might be if you go to a certain restaurant the same day each week, is the way the meal's prepared obviously different? Is someone else cooking any meals for you at home? Are you chopping and changing between different brands of, say, rice or whatever it is? and the calories are actually quite different, all the portions that they present on the nutrition label. So if you're kind of running the list of those, just trying to exhaust everything, and again, asking, if it's a two-way conversation, asking what they feel some of the more obvious ones might be, or where they may be being less attentive and diligent than they were a few months ago with tracking, and just trying to troubleshoot that. And that might be kind of where the end of the line is, like, oh, I'm obviously having like 200 calories extra in butter every day. Okay, that's the obvious thing for a start there.
That's an easy win, yeah.
Yeah, but if all those are okay, then the next step would be kind of presenting the options for change. So you're kind of taking the personal stuff out of the equation with like stress tolerance varying between different people. On paper, if this was to apply to BLS and CLS routines, it might look like the kind of full list of adjustments would be all the way up to, let's say, 5 lifting days a week, 5 cardio sessions, and somewhere in like the 10 to 15 K steps per day range, and then all the way down to around BMR on the calories. That might be the ceiling for all those variables. So we'd see where they are across that board.
And just to clarify for people listening, that being the maximum recommended amount of exercise and the minimum, let's say, BMR being the cutoff for minimum recommended calories for diet for most people, just trying to give general guidelines, because more exercise than that, some people can get away with quite a bit more than that. Maybe not weightlifting. There probably is about a hard cutoff of, I would say, 7 hours per week, especially if you're in a deficit. Even if you're 20 years old and invincible, that's got to be more than that. It's just going to be a problem. And on the cardio side of things, some people, for probably psychological and physical reasons, they can endure more abuse than others. But about 5 hours probably of each per week is, I think, a good general guideline. I agree. And then on the BMR, so that's for people listening, think of that as the amount of calories that your basal metabolic rate, or you could, it's not exactly the same as resting metabolic rate, but you maybe have heard resting metabolic rate more often, and that's the amount of calories your body burns over 24 hours at rest. So if you were just to basically lie in bed all day, how much energy does your body burn? And generally speaking, if you start eating less than that for a long enough period, you're going to experience more severe side effects, some of the stuff associated, negative stuff associated with dieting. So anyway, I didn't want to interject, just want to clarify for people not sure what that meant.
Yeah, sure.
So let's assume they have, yes, their diet is not the problem and you don't see any issues there.
Yeah, so got past that first step. Consistency, accuracy, especially on the nutrition front, everything looks great. They're not missing workouts. Second step would be, again, then looking at, and it, this would also be probably giving it a good amount of time, like a solid 2 weeks to, you know, identify water anomalies. Like, we're happy with how the data looks and agreed, yeah, we're at a plateau at this point. So moving on to the next step would be seeing what room they've got left in each of those areas. So if they're only doing 4 days per week and they could do 5, that's an area for increase. If they're doing cardio twice a week, think about the units could go to 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. If they're only walking 3,000 steps per day, they've got a lot of room to increase the daily steps. They might be 300 calories above the BMR. So they've got a lot of room to adjust there. So the usual options would be, on average, I would just look at, you can either add a lifting session or like half a session to a full session. You could add a cardio workout. You could add 1,000, 2,000 steps a day. Or you could cut 100, 150 calories. And those are kind of what I would start as an average range for each of those.
And do you prefer to start with increasing activity rather than decreasing food, if possible?
That's one of those things where on paper you would probably say, yeah, I want to keep as much food in as possible, but that's where I would present those options to them and be like, what makes sense for you?
Yep. So practically speaking, to get to the goal, in your experience, it doesn't matter so much which way you go. What matters more is that it works for the client and it's something that they are comfortable with and can stick with.
Yeah, exactly. And then at the same time, I wouldn't kind of intentionally probe towards any the perception of these changes, but if it seemed like someone was maybe, you know, really worried about, oh, I've cut 100 calories, then I'm not going to get enough of this. I'm not going to get enough of that. If there's anything that seems like that you're majoring in the minors when everything else has been checked, like the protein's fine, the fruit and veg is fine, we might unpack that and just make sure they're not overly stressed about any of those adjustments. And again, just make sure that we're filling any kind of blanks in their knowledge as we go. But for the most part, it would be presenting the options, let them have autonomy over the decision and own the decision as well. Like they can decide what's is working well for them, what they enjoy. This is, you know, it's not an irreversible decision. Like if they trim their food intake a little bit and they get over that plateau, but they feel like, actually, I much prefer eating a little bit more food and I have way more time on the weekend than I realized, then we just switch it. I'm like, oh, you know, 100 calories back in and make that increase on the activity. It's, again, then that would be something where a little mental kind of shift of, is someone looking at those adjustments is like irreversible and putting a huge amount of stress in it and making the process harder than it needs to be.
Hey there. If you are hearing this, you are still listening, which is awesome. Thank you. And if you are enjoying this podcast, or if you just like my podcast in general and you are getting at least something out of it, would you mind sharing it with a friend or a loved one or a not so loved one even who might want to learn something new? Word of mouth helps really bigly in growing the show. So if you think of someone who might like this episode or another one, please do tell them about it. Before we kind of continue on our flow chart, so to speak, could you give us a few examples, and as many as you think would be worth sharing, of just real life examples of how you have applied the stuff that you've been talking about with clients to unstick them, to get the needle moving again? I think it might be helpful for people to hear in real life terms, in maybe some different circumstances, how this actually goes.
Yeah, so the main ones that come to mind are usually around doing deep dives on, it tends to be, as usually nutrition adjustment is the way to go for a lot of people, because we get the training tends to be a little bit more step and forget. So once that's in place, it's not super rare that we adjust the training, but it's often just small things around niggles in the gym, aches and pains. It doesn't tend to be in relation to fat loss plateaus. A lot of the like in the weeds examples tend to be, there's no one person that comes to mind right now, but it's always the same kind of process of, again, that user experience kind of approach of like, let's look at like how many meals you're having per day, like how do you feel after each meal, do you feel particularly satiated and certain points in the day at which you feel hungrier, like you don't feel like eating and you're kind of just forcing the meal in robotically, and then looking at the upside and downside of that. Of there's always the upside of sticking to routine and just making it autonomous and just getting the reps in regardless. And then at the same time, not doing it to a point where you're doing a disservice to yourself and making things unenjoyable. So we usually would go through each meal, look at which ones make the most sense for reducing calories. Like maybe, say someone prepares like overnight oats one evening for before work the next day. And just looking at like, okay, I have this fruit in it, I might have a banana or two in it, I add a little bit of peanut butter, I add X amount of oats, I add a scoop of protein powder. Cool, we might look at that meal and say, okay, we could very simply just take one banana out and maybe a little bit of peanut butter off, and it's going to basically be still just as enjoyable, the same preparation time, but it's going to be that 100-150 calories less.
That was my last cut, was I just stopped eating the overnight oats. It's probably about 300 calories. Like, cool, I'm gonna cut for a little bit.
Yeah,
I guess that's it. I'm just going to delete that. And there it is. There's my new meal plan.
Yeah. And that's something where, you know, you'll have, having done this for so long, you'll have such a just inbuilt intuition for that. Whereas, again, someone who's maybe never done any kind of mindfulness practices on nuts and bolts nutrition stuff, like deleting breakfast is like, that might be, you know, setting alarm bells off them, and then, you know, just kind of snowballs into other stresses.
Which actually is the question I want to ask you. So then, out of curiosity, have you noticed certain patterns where people, they tend to conform to hypes, in a sense, where you'll see certain people generally, okay, they follow this pattern of, They liked what they really prefer is they prefer to have most of their calories early versus later. So you have to make that kind of adjustment. Mm. Or they, let's see, they have a hard time controlling themselves when they eat certain types of foods, or maybe it's just sugar, and it actually is better for them to just leave sugar out altogether, or other such things where, again, people listening might find that they tend to follow one of these patterns as well. And so certain types of adjustments, or at least there are certain factors that could be very important for some people and not matter at all for others.
Yes. It's something to try. I try not to almost maybe box clients into like maybe different avatars or like behavior patterns or expectations, just that I don't want to go into, say, problem solving something with the client with any kind of heavy bias towards something. Or
yeah. Yeah, I mean more just kind of retroactively, like looking back on it and going, oh, that's kind of interesting. There seem to be some patterns here, not that perfectly predicts future behavior, but
yeah, that would really be it. It would decline. It would be that back and forth of looking for the like the patterns, because then we can start to build solutions around it. Because we all have a lot of overlap, and individually, like, we're all like very messy in our own ways, but there is a lot of overlap between people in these instances, especially when, you know, you take, say, somebody who's middle-aged, family life, career-focused, struggling with the weight for about a decade. Like, there's going to be a lot of similarities, but then just the main differences between all those people. So the same kind of thing, again, is we'll have that back and forth and maybe go right back to the start and look at the main one, two pain points that comes to us with, and look at why those happening over and over again, and try and look at maybe both the in the trenches day-to-day things that, again, I'm stress eating after work, these two or three triggers throughout the afternoon, every day, the things that I need to get in check and address. And then at the same time, just seeing if there's anything that bleeds over everywhere else, because then that might help us see, oh, this time I am someone who maybe struggles with all or nothing thinking a lot more than I realize. So just trying to look at maybe the presentation of those like habits or issues that recur, and just trying to, again, always those things go, like, I'm not therapists or doctors, but just trying to see where any of those habits and behaviors recur, so that you see that might be that same issue might crop up in various other places in their life, and that's something where we can maybe put some preventative measures in place to help them avoid being too all or nothing with it.
That makes sense. Let me come back to the exercise and to that dial, so to speak. So there's the frequency, there's the duration, and then there's the intensity. Particularly with cardio, people will ask me this. They'll understand that, okay, so let's say I'm doing 5 cardio workouts per week, or maybe even 7, if though the duration and the intensity is also calibrated properly. But let's say they're going, I'm doing my 5 cardio sessions per week. Can I make those sessions longer? Can I make some of those sessions some sort of high intensity, maybe it's sprint training or high intensity interval training? How do you normally approach the cardio in particular?
Yeah, so similar to the lifting, like we would start with much like you recommend on podcast books, like a steady mix of mostly moderate intensity, a little bit of HIIT training if they want to, and then a solid step count each day, which as a floor might be 7,000 steps and ceiling 10,000, just make sure you stay in that range most of the time. So that might be a good on paper place to start. So depending on like how much back and forth I've had with a client, we might have to split that in place if they've noted down they have that capacity and willingness on the consultation form. But then again, when we go through that first conversation, before diving into those variables, and this again applies to like nutrition, the training, the cardio, it can be very easy to kind of jump into those burrows and rabbit holes of, let's discuss like the frequency, the duration, like which exercises you enjoy. Before all of that, I would probably go a level above and look at some of the broader behavior change things of like, what do you enjoy the most? Like, what have you stuck to most in the past? It's realistic with your routine. Are there any like habits or things on the edges of your training sessions that make it easier or harder to get in? And then relating that to that goal, like if you have, say, a more advanced lifter who, again, he's maybe been following BLS for 5, 6, 7 years and they want to cut. They might be in a position where they suddenly have a very stressful job or personal circumstances have changed, and maybe just fluidly following BLS where they can kind of just go in and enjoy getting the pump and keep the intensity a little bit lower might be perfect for them. So jumping into the weeds of like exercise selection and so forth. For that person, it might be, again, they might almost be majoring in humanities, even though on paper for pretty much everyone, those things are important. So it's a little bit of investigative work at the right at the very top. And then I would go through like cranking those dials up and down according to what makes sense for them.
And with the cardio and with the higher intensity stuff in particular, again, I'm just thinking with the questions that I often get asked.
Yeah.
How much, if somebody, you said if they want to do it. And so first I wanted to follow up on that because, I mean, there was a time going all the way back to at least the first edition of Bigger, Leaner, Stronger for sure. I think the second edition where I was pretty bullish on high intensity interval training. Some of the research that was making the rounds at the time looked very promising, that you didn't just have the additional calorie burning, but you also had some other mechanistic stuff going on that meant you were burning even more body fat in those workouts and that your post-workout body fat burning was higher as well. And now you fast forward to today and the fourth edition of that book and also of the women's book is the cardio recommendations are very different, basically in line with what we're talking about. And unfortunately, I was just recently looking at some research showing that the way that most people do HIIT training, unfortunately, when you look at the total calorie expenditure per unit of time, it actually isn't even that much higher because of the rest intervals. If you're in really good cardiovascular shape and you can do long sprints and relatively short rest intervals, then of course, I mean, then yeah, you're gonna burn more calories in 15 minutes of that than 15 minutes of zone two. But if you're not in great cardiovascular shape and you're doing relatively short intervals with equal or longer rest periods, then unfortunately, you're not even getting really additional calorie burning out of it. And then unfortunately, the other physiological advantages that were speculated years ago didn't pan out. And so that's not to say that HIIT isn't good or it isn't useful, but I have heavily de-emphasized it in my, not just books, but podcasts and articles, the educational stuff that I continue to produce. And so anyway, when you're working with clients and if they want to do it, then do you have a ceiling on how much you recommend that they do of high intensity stuff?
Yeah, it's a general ceiling. Again, like on paper, it would be similar to lifting of like, you know, if you're doing a long lifting, a couple hours a week max on top of that, like the old VLS approach where perhaps someone do 4 or 5 days of lifting and they can work up to maybe 20 to 30 minutes of intervals on the back end of each of those sessions, if that's what they're aiming for. The usual approach though is looking at, especially with most clients we work with, the lifting, of course, is where the specific training is. The cardio is more kind of just under the exercise bucket, where it's not necessarily incremental each week.
It's the supplement. It's the supplement of the The training is the meal plan.
Yeah, and the only real kind of box that we look to tick with the cardio is stick to an amount that's going to be relatively similar week to week, so that you've got reliable data when you're assessing things. Try and get it's good to get a mix across the board. Like if you can, similar to lifting, like if you can have a little bit higher intense work and a good stretch of reasonably intense stuff, and then like the walk on top of it is nice too. It would again be just looking at week to week, what's the volume of cardio that suits you in terms of time alongside of lifting? What types of cardio do you enjoy? And then just how's it going? And then once that's in place, just make sure it's not interfering with anything. It's not adding too much stress. It's manageable. It's enjoyable. It's easy to slot in alongside the weightlifting. And then we have the data then to look at, oh, we're 2 months into a program. We have hit a plateau. We've done 1 hour of moderate intensity cardio per week over the weekend. And you've done 2 10-minute HIIT sessions after you're lifting because you enjoy them. Cool. You've done that every week. We can add another small HIIT session if that's what you want, so we can increase the steady state or the step count each day.
And when you're making these adjustments, how are you looking at it in terms of adjusting energy balance? So if you're going to make a food adjustment, how many calories are you pulling out of their total daily caloric intake? If you're making an exercise adjustment, are you looking to achieve a certain number or range of additional calorie expenditure? Like, what is enough to get through that plateau and to start losing weight steadily again, in your experience?
Yeah, but for the average person, it's probably going to be 100 to 150 calories removed from the diet, or an extra session, whether it's lifting or cardio, or an extra 1,000 or so steps a day. Usually just looking at those three or four options and letting them decide based on their circumstances and preferences. And if someone's, you know, on the smaller side, we might cap it at 100 calories. If someone's only eating, you know, I've trained clients who are 100 pounds and they still have body fat to lose because they're very small people.
Yeah. Or if they're already like kind of lean and they're trying to get really lean.
Yeah. I mean, it might be that. And then this would probably be a decision on their part of, I would actually prefer to maybe just cut like 50 to 100 calories and get my walking in, because then you can start looking at other questions, which are going to be, again, kind of one solution to them, where they might start to build up the intuition of, yeah, as I get deeper into a cut, I start to notice my stress, my sensitivity to stress goes up. I prefer being outside more. That's more important to me. So the step count makes more sense than the crowding gym. It might even be that we have to make some really nuanced changes that deep, where we maybe even reduce the lifting volume a little bit if they're not recovering from it, and increase the step count, because that's the thing that they feel can kind of just keep going with without any stress. So
it's also a good lifestyle habit.
Yeah.
Be in the habit of moving enough outside of the gym is important for overall health and wellness. It's not just a fat loss intervention.
Yeah. And internally building that problem solving skill set. Like, you know, people, if you reverse engineer those things, you can apply it to like issues of work and like issues with, like, oh, I'm, you know, maybe the relationship I have, my lifestyle with my friends and others, not where I want it to be. Like, what solutions can I put in place? I can do more of this, do less of that. I can ask questions of what people want from me, more or less. It's a good, it's good mental framework for thinking about things.
And it is a mindset that you have to get into. And sometimes you have to will yourself into it. There's the two very clearly distinguished mindsets. You have the problem making mindset and you have the problem solving mindset. And sometimes we all get stuck in the problem making mindset, where we are not even, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we're not even really trying to find a solution. We're still just kind of wallowing in the problem.
Mm. Yeah. And it's, again, that's where some of the almost vulnerability of coaching happens, where when you're talking with someone, you're looking at, again, going back to that same example, maybe someone who's stress eating after work and they've been thinking for years, like, oh, if this person wasn't at work, if that person wasn't at work, or if I didn't have a boss that forced me to go through these things. And it's like, it takes a long time to make that shift of like, maybe this is on me to fix.
Yeah. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's the person's fault too. I think fault, that word has the wrong connotations. You could say it's on them, or it's their responsibility to do something about it, even if it's not their fault per se. That, I mean, in some cases, it is our fault. Sometimes we make bad decisions, we do stupid things that create stupid problems, and then we have to fix them. Okay, fine. That's our fault. But other times it's not so cut and dried. We find ourselves in situations that seem out of our control, and anyone and the most objective observer would be hard pressed to explain why it's our quote unquote fault. And that's okay. I think it's important though, to just to understand that if you say, okay, it's my responsibility to fix this, I'm going to do something to fix this, that isn't also saying, oh, well, this is all my fault and I'm wrong because of, you know, the outcome. And it's just a mindset point that I personally have found helpful in dealing with difficult situations.
Yeah. Yes, it seems small, but that's one of those really significant shifts that can overhaul the trajectory of someone's willingness to change as they go through all these uncomfortable shifts. And it does present that good opportunity for, you know, improving our self-talk, how fairly or unfairly we judge ourselves because of those decisions. And as a result, the decisions we make thereafter. It does present, like, you know, there's always going to be that initial discomfort of realizing, not necessarily realizing, but thinking over, like, what could I have done better here? What could I have done better there?
Which I think that's useful too, personally. I mean, I am a big advocate of thinking that way. Again, without blame or fault or guilt, but objectively assessing a situation and asking, so did I do something to contribute to this situation? Even if it is in an oblique way, it's indirect, could I have done something differently that maybe would have improved the outcome, would have averted some element of whatever happened? And then what lessons or what lesson can I learn from this? What's something I can take away from this to avoid getting myself into the same situation again? And I think that's a useful process to work through when, I mean, I find it when I get an outcome that I didn't want, and just to take a little bit of time and to think through those things again, without blame, without fault, and then move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of going back to like one of the questions you asked before about the, if there's any maybe recurring themes with clients or similar trends, but it's something where someone can identify something that's come up over and over again. And once they go through that initial, maybe internal discomfort and start to kind of ride the wave and not maybe allow themselves to get pulled into some of those rabbit holes of like snowballing on negative self-talk or so on, and start to move towards being objective, it's actually, that can be life-changing for a lot of people. And they realize that, like, oh, maybe I'm a little bit more all or nothing with some of my behaviors. And if I just acted a little bit more in the middle on some of these things, I would, you know, have A out from there and B out from there, and it would be, you know, not as, you know, maybe not quite as a dramatic shift as I expect. Like, just a couple of small adjustments to what I'm doing day to day could be that missing digit on the password that unlocks that binary difference, that 5% shift.
I want to come back to something you mentioned, which is, you didn't say the word overtraining, but many people, when they hear you or anyone talk about when you're doing too much, and then they think of that as overtraining, which, if we look to scientific literature, overtraining syndrome is much harder to achieve than many people think. However, you can push things too far, especially when you're dieting, and you can experience symptoms, I guess you could say, that are related to overtraining. There's an imbalance in terms of stress and recovery that certainly can happen. And practically speaking, what does that usually look like in clients? What are the symptoms? What are the red flags that when you start seeing these things, you know that, okay, this is, we're probably redlining, or we're getting close to it. And then what works practically speaking? And I want to throw something else out there just because it's related. A lot of people talk about it. It's still kind of controversial, reverse dieting, because many people would say, oh yeah, well, you just need to reverse diet. Like, here are the things that you're going to share, signs that you're probably doing too much and you should just reverse diet. So you can comment on that as well as you were answering.
Yeah, just to look at some of the maybe warning signs around overtraining or kind of issues that people fall into with that. Again, then we would. And so it kind of depends on where a coach is with a client, or a client terms parameter selection have done, as to what the issue is going to be. So when we have a client on the program, we might get put them on a standard routine and a standard BLS, TLS routine. And we might find as we go that the overtraining actually shows up differently. Like, as they get stronger, they might need to do a little bit less barbell work and barbell on the front end, machines on the back end. Some of those things may just, we might kind of iterate through them as they come up.
And what would occur to make you think of that? What feedback are you getting?
Yeah, things like several weeks of training consistency, but then diet compliance is slowly slipping off. Recovery is slowly worsening.
And when you say recovery is worsening, sorry to inject, I want to make sure I get these questions so I don't just forget them. But when you say recovery is worsening, what does that look like specifically? Because again, if people are new to this, they don't really know how am I recovered? I don't know. My muscles are sore. Is that good? Is that bad? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. If you find that The soreness is probably worsening week to week, even though the training is very stable. You find that your mood is generally getting a little bit worse. If sleep isn't as consistent, general stress levels are going up, irritability is worse, general mood and outlook is a little bit dampened. Any of those, and they might vary person to person. If you overtrain, your sleep might be terrible. If I overtrain, may just get really stiff joints, for instance. Like, it can vary person to person.
Yeah, joints were always a thing for me.
Yeah.
My joints would wouldn't feel good when I'm working out. Everything would just feel kind of stiff in between workouts.
Yeah, so we kind of look at those and then see, okay, like the training on paper looks great. So yeah, then be looking at some of the simple adjustments around it of, we've got a deload planned after 10 weeks. Let's maybe do one every 6 weeks instead until we get to our goal. Again, looking at individual workouts, you might find for one person, a back workout, for instance, might look like barbell deadlifts, barbell row, weighted pull-ups. Just switching maybe, keep the barbell deadlift in place and then maybe doing a cable row and a lat pull down. It's going to be 90% as effective, but it might be half the stress for some people because it's a little bit less free weight work, a little bit less overall load. So yeah, just kind of backtracking and see if there's any subtle changes that are going to not allow that stress to accrue. It's probably what we'd look at once some of those symptoms start to kick in.
And are the adjustments normally made to the weightlifting rather than the cardio? And is that more often the culprit if the excess stress is coming from the exercise?
Probably. I would almost say like the HIIT training, if they're doing high-intensity cardio and lifting, I would probably look at that in the same bracket because it's really the same on paper. It's kind of both pushing close to failure and much higher intensity, and then the lower intensity work is generally much easier to recover from.
Especially if the HIIT training, I'm sure you don't recommend this, but if people insist on doing something that is high impact, like just sprinting on a hard surface, for example.
Like box jumps, burpees, things like that.
Yeah.
And for that, I would pull into like the lifting as well. But to answer the second
question. And what about
reverse dieting?
Exactly. What about?
Yeah. Yes, it's more, when I say reverse dieting, I kind of always use it as a loose term of just like coming out of the deficit back to maintenance. Like some people, they feel fine to jump right up. Some people like the traditional approach of going up in increments. Some people like to go somewhere in between. It really, again, really comes down to almost looking at going back and forth with the client to get their take on it and what we've done in the past. But you might find that one person has finished a very lengthy cut and they're maybe just generally quite relaxed. They're not, they don't overthink much of the process. They're very much just like, tell me what to do. I'm happy to go about it. They don't have some of the stresses going on that makes this difficult for me. And they can just like, cool, I can just jump straight back to maintenance, just the training volume down a little bit. And if the scale goes up a couple of pounds, like I'm cool with that. Other people may find that even if it's not necessarily essential, they would just feel better working up in maybe if they're a 700 calorie deficit, 150-ish calorie jumps, three or four of those might see them better. So
in my experience over the years, many women have preferred that just because they didn't want to see a big jump on the scale. Even though they understood, they knew what they were doing, and it just was a matter of personal preference. And I think that's a perfectly valid reason to do it that way.
Yeah, I also wonder if this is one that, maybe even if we don't articulate it or necessarily think it at the time, like there might be certain reasons we're in tune with of like just knowing that I know my compliance is going to be better if I do it steady. Like I don't need to explain it to myself. I just feel it.
That's another good point too. Some people, I'm just thinking over the years, answering many emails from people and seeing a lot of different situations. And that was definitely seemed to be one of those things, just like how some people I had mentioned earlier, they find that they have trouble controlling their food intake with certain kinds of foods. You had mentioned earlier 100 calories of wine. Some people can do that and that they're totally fine with that and they're happy and they generally don't drink any more than that. And other people, 100 calories of wine, I would liken that to, I don't drink, but I can relate to it with ice cream. For me, 100 calories of ice cream, it's not that I'm going to spiral out of control and eat the whole pint, but it's so unsatisfying, I just wouldn't even bother. If I'm going to eat ice cream and I want to get satisfied, at least half of the pint has to be eaten or I'm just completely unsatisfied. So if it's only 100 calories, I'm going to go for like dark chocolate because at least I know I find that satisfying, right? And so anyway, there are how people can find that for them, they either should completely avoid certain things like chips, for example. 100 calories of chips, nope, doesn't work for me. I just don't want to even have chips in my pantry because I like them too much and I just know that it's going to be a problem. Well, then I think similarly, and again, I've seen this to your point of people who they're done cutting or they're going to be taking a break and they know that if they add those 500 or 700 calories to their meal plan, it's going to include foods that maybe they're going to struggle to control their intake. They just, as you said, they feel more comfortable with being able to stick to a plan of gradually working their calories back up rather than just adding a large number of calories that may increase hunger, for example. I mean, that's how it's always been for me. Ironically, I experience more hunger when I'm lean bulking than when I'm cutting. Even if I've been cutting for a couple of months in the past, you know, I've gotten pretty lean for photo shoots and so forth. Generally speaking, more hunger, lean bulking, especially leading up to meals, where I actually really get hungry when I'm lean bulking leading up to a meal. Whereas if I'm cutting or maintaining, not really. Maybe I get a little bit of I feel a little bit of hunger here and there. And so just generally related to kind of this personalization theme of this talk is it's important to know how you respond to things, even if in the case of reverse dieting, the most recent scientific literature, I would say it more or less debunks, I think, some of the claims that have been made about reverse dieting over the last several years, implying that it's superior to just raising calories to maintenance or that you can even use it to kind of supercharge your metabolism. Do you agree with that? Do you, like, practically speaking, working with people, have you found any form of reverse dieting useful? And let's exclude just bringing your calories back to maintenance, because I would say that's just bringing your calories back to maintenance. But aside from the people who just prefer to do it that way, I'm just curious, has it been a useful tool or not really? It's just for the people who don't want to increase their calories by large amounts overnight.
Yeah, I think in the early days, you know, before more of the recent research came out, people, you know, probably just done it out of more security. Like, we know this works. Like,
it's always out of caution. It's like, it's not going to hurt.
Yeah. 2 weeks to maybe not screw up the last 6 months is probably wise. Let's just take a little bit longer. Once we got over that and it was like more of a case-by-case, whatever option suits you approach, there wasn't anything major, really. It was probably, again, it kind of just reverses back to that. What is your preference? Like, what does your gut tell you? What feels right for you in terms of pacing? And because, again, I think even if we didn't necessarily go back and forth the clients over, like, sure, maybe you'll get more food and be able to, like, feel a little bit better in the gym sooner. I guess those things tend to just be more intuition, for especially for people who, if they're at a point where they're doing a reverse diet, they've done at least a few weeks and months of this where they're, you know, they know the way around the gym, they know the way around the kitchen, they understand how to pace things both in terms of strength training and weight loss and weight gain. So they've got a good intuition of everything. And it's often those small upsides of, I may be able to get a little bit stronger in the gym next month if I just jump straight to maintenance instead of a reverse diet. It doesn't even tend to necessarily be a topic of conversation. It just becomes more of what suits me with this reverse diet, and not even necessarily trying to like dig really deep into it or like, you know, fighting against someone if like, oh, I really want to reverse diet cautiously. It's just whatever suits you. Like, it's, you know, you're in the deep end of cut, you're stressed, like, we don't need to add more complication or friction to this. Like, you know, our brains are just like pattern recognition machines. Like, it'll just do what we'll just do what feels best, and we have a few options in front of us. Whatever's comfortable, let's go with that. And, you know, I don't care if it takes an extra 10 days than it might have been doing it the fast way. Let's just get it done in a way that suits you. And again, you take ownership over it. You do it this way this time. If you want to try it a different way next time, great. And then you've got, for your circumstances and preferences, you've got that data then of, this is how I felt doing it slowly, this is how I felt doing it quickly.
Makes sense. And last question for you, and that's diet breaks. And I wanted to bring this up because if you only looked at the scientific literature, you might be a little bit confused because you're going to find some literature that suggests that it's very useful, maybe even advantageous to include diet breaks, similar to how you would include deloads. If you were to take a diet period of 6 months, you can find some research that would suggest that you're going to get better results with regular diet breaks over those 6 months than not taking diet breaks. Then you could find research that contradicts that and says, no, you won't. On average, you actually might get worse results because you're going to spend less time in a deficit. So practically speaking, how have you used diet breaks? How useful has that been? How necessary has that been? When might you call for that or not?
Yeah, similar to the overtraining, it's like looking at, you know, when someone's in a deficit and they're cutting, I kind of look at things like hunger, fatigue, brain fog, irritability. Like, I kind of just call them like dieting symptoms, like in my head when I'm thinking all these things and looking at them on a 1 to 10 scale. And like, as the dial cranks up, and, you know, for a lot of people, they're going to have maybe a 2 or 3-ish out of 10 hunger a couple of times a day. Like, it's just before the main meals, for instance. Like, you're just probably going to have that for the next 3 months whilst you cook. That's kind of just the reality of it. And we'll do everything we can around it to minimize it. Some people don't have any, but that's maybe just a standard baseline.
And it's okay for people listening. It's okay. It's okay to feel hungry, especially when you're dieting. Doesn't mean anything's wrong.
Yeah, opens up the avenue, not to go on a big tangent, opens up the avenue for other things like not reacting to the hunger, like knowing it's okay, testing out different stresses, managing stress. But yeah, going through the like dieting symptoms, seeing how much like the training in the gym, how stress and fatigue in the gym might increase over time. Same for those, if hunger, irritability, focus, if all those things are creeping in the wrong direction in steady increments, a diet break would make sense preventatively. Like, no one, it's often a bit of a back and forth when clients, you know, they're several weeks into a cut, they're doing very well, and they add those things that are moving in the wrong direction to where it makes sense to diet break. It is with some folks to get them on board with the idea of, let's eat at maintenance for a week. So like, I'm doing so well, I don't want to stop now, but oftentimes they'll push it that extra 2 or 3 weeks, and had they just had a diet break there, those dieting symptoms would have been dialed all the way back to a healthy baseline, and they would have been able to push for another 10 weeks. It's more about prevention in that case. Like, always, much like deloads, if you can do, you know, say a diet break every somewhere in like the 6 to 12 week range, whatever suits someone, if depending on the size of the deficit, other stresses going on in life, just seeing where it makes sense to fit that in. Again, just short circuit that increase of negative symptoms is what we'd be looking at.
And I'm sure that I know that, you know, you've worked with many, I guess you'd say, kind of type A personalities and those types of people in particular. I understand, I lean that way myself. We can be stubborn about
almost everything.
Yeah, bludgeon our way through. We've decided this is what we're going to do. And generally speaking, we don't want to let people or things stop us. And so I do understand that. But as you said, it can be, there's a point where it can make things harder than they need to be, or it can actually become counterproductive, because if you build up too much stress, and so you've been in a deficit now for a while, you're training pretty intensely, and maybe you should have taken it easier a couple of weeks ago to bring the, let's just say, the overall stress down from, let's say, a 7 to a 4 or something like that. And now it's at a 9, that same little intervention, that little 1 week diet break, it may not be enough, actually. That may only bring it down to a 7. So now you actually have to take it easy for 2 weeks to get it down to the 4 so you can go at it for another, you know, couple of months. Or you don't do that. You just take the, let's say, 5 days at maintenance, and maybe you take a deload, and okay, stress comes from 9 to 7. And now you're running into the same problems though 3 weeks later. And then what? And many people, in my experience, again, especially people who are more driven, kind of like tougher, masculine type of people, they then maybe are even more reluctant to address it this second time, because it's only been 3 weeks, and I'm not gonna take another diet break. I'm just gonna rub some dirt on it and keep going.
Yeah, in those instances, you would probably look at, again, like the system as a whole. Like, is the training plan a little too strenuous? Is the deficit that's set a little too aggressive? Are there other stresses outside the gym that we can dial back? Yeah, I'm just trying. And it's tough because a lot of, you know, we've asked like hundreds of people who are like very type A, and some people can just genuinely grind all the way to the finish line and then be fine. Other people can grind all the way through, have a horrible bounce back, and then other people are on the other end of, they'll just keep getting to like the 8 to 10 week wall and just bouncing back because they're not getting those rests in sooner rather than later. So it is tricky, especially because in other areas of the life, it may have worked very well just brute forcing things, even if it could have been done a little bit calmer or more elegantly. If you can brute force it, it's like, that's the data that they've gotten, and it's, I'm just going to apply that to everything else. And it works in that department, so it should work here as well. So it does become a tricky, again, another one of those tricky things to overcome of, you know, questioning, like reflecting and looking at ourselves, like looking at what we're doing wrong. It gets uncomfortable for people at that stage, but that could be where some of those really, really crucial pivots happen. Like for some folks who've had, who are maybe very type A, we may see them, you know, almost, instead of making, like, you can apply this to, say, diet quality, where you have people who are clean eating and they're going to be 100% on 100% of their diet from whole foods, whereas like you can be 100% focused on being 80-20. It's like, apply that same kind of type A attitude about like 80-20 is what perfection looks like. Make that the goal, because it's a small shift for some people, but it makes a, again, that can be the difference of like, yeah, I'm going to rest better than anyone else rests when I'm resting. Like that's how I'm going to be type A about this.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And, you know, I can relate to that. I've always been, in my fitness in particular, the just get it done. If it gets hard, just keep going. And that's worked fine for me. And some of the, if we're talking about cutting in the past, none of it was particularly grueling, but could I have made it a little bit more pleasant by incorporating a diet break here and there, maybe doing a little bit more deloading? Yes. But I did it the way I did it, and there were no negative circumstances or negative consequences of that. And so if you're that kind of person, that's fine too. If you know that, yeah, you know that physiologically nothing's wrong, you know, as you said, you have these symptoms and they're a little bit annoying, but you know that you're not breaking your metabolism, you're not losing a bunch of muscle, like it's fine. You just don't feel great, and you'd rather just gut it out for another 3 weeks and be done. Okay, good, then do it. But again, this is a point of self-awareness and knowing that that isn't going to then result in a big rebound because you are so sick of controlling your food and you're so hungry and your sleep is so bad and your mood is so terrible that you're going to undo, you know, 6 months of work in the following month.
Yeah. Yeah. And that intensity lever of like, being more on a plan for a certain time frame versus not, like you can push pull in as you want. And almost coming full circle to the conversation I have with people is like defining what things look like long term we're not looking at like what is a perfect day in a year's time. It's like, what is, you know, a yearly cycle or a few years look like for you? And for some people it may be, you know, I'll just have like a nice maintenance phase. You know, say someone's in your position where they've built a lot of muscle, they've gotten as lean as they want, and for them, it might be, you know, have fun just maintaining them for 10 months. I'll let myself just kind of eat what I want over the holidays, and then I'll just do like a 6 to 8 week cut. And that's when I'll like crank the intensity up because I'm choosing to do so. I'm not like succumbing to like the what feels like an out of control crash diet. It's like I'm choosing and taking ownership to crank that intensity up. That's what I'm going to do. And then I'm going to enjoy it in a way that I enjoy it the rest of the time. And I can like paint that picture however I want. And you know, change it whenever I want, as long as I can take ownership and it leads to the outcome I want. Most of the behaviors are aligned, and that's what success looks like for most people.
That's the dream. That's really the end game for people listening who are relatively new to this, or maybe just in the middle of this. I think that is the big payoff, aside from health and longevity and all the other benefits. But if we're talking about body composition, that is the big payoff of all the work that you do on the front end for the first few years, then you have the flexibility to do exactly what Harry just said. I mean, that's what I do. I'm maintaining in the gym. And so I'm making sure that I enjoy my workouts. I'm doing exercises that I like to do. I'm doing enough volume to to obviously maintain most of the strength and all of the muscle that I have. And it is about 3 to 4 hours of lifting per week. That's all the weightlifting I want to do right now. I do cardio on top of that. That's most of the year. And over the holidays, I mean, I probably gain a little bit of fat. I don't care that much to eat large amounts of calories. But to your point, I'm also not making sure that I'm not weighing and measuring my Thanksgiving dinner. I eat what I'm going to eat. And if I, at the end of that, if I gained more fat than I wanted, then I cut for a little bit and rinse and repeat. And it's great. And it's a lifestyle that I enjoy. And it's something that I'll be able to do. And you and everybody listening, we can do that for the rest of our life. And we can stay in really, really good shape doing it that way.
Mm. Yeah, it is for most people. That is, the ideal spot where they just get to loosely maintain a BLS, TLS type routine. We do actually have some clients, though, they just love like the process and science of it that much that even though they're only at, say, gaining a pound of muscle a year, 2 pounds of muscle, they just still love doing like a step bulk, a step cut each year, a little bit of maintenance. And again, so it's all the other there.
Which I also, I actually do understand. I mean, I did that for a while too. I guess that maybe this is just the season I'm in my life, but I get that as well. I mean, it also is fun, especially when you're maintaining a consistent calorie surplus. And if somebody hasn't done that before, I found that they're often surprised at how big of a difference that makes in the gym. Like once you've established that for a couple of weeks, it seems to take a couple of weeks to really get the physiological gears moving faster. But once that reaches a certain threshold, it can be shocking just how much stronger you get in the gym and how much more energy you have for your workouts and even just how your body feels and how you feel that additional recovery and so forth. So I get it. That's fun too, actually.
Yeah, it's huge. Like especially if you combine, say, like sleep quality, someone's systemic stress and their food, like all those things in the right or wrong direction, it can be, especially on big exercises like squats and deadlifts, where 10% is a huge amount of weight. It can be a drastic, like 40, 50 pound swing.
Yes,
huge.
Totally. Well, that was everything that I had on my list. I think that was a great conversation. Is there anything that you think that we should have covered, I should have asked, that you want to say before we wrap up?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think that's kind of everything I can think of on the client side. Maybe worth doing from like a coaching tool perspective at some point. But I think, again, a lot of the tools and processes that we work through, I think covered. I guess, if anyone has any questions, you can always step out at the moment to me.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for taking the time, Harry. And why don't we tell people where they can find you, find your work? Is there anything in particular that you want them to know about?
Honestly, there's not. I've not got like much of a web presence to do this.
I wasn't sure, but I thought I would ask.
Yeah, I'm happy just to like quietly get on with my work. That suits me. but I guess if anyone wants to reach me, Harry and Legion Supplements is the way to go.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Harry.
Well, I hope you liked this episode. I hope you found it helpful. And if you did, subscribe to the show because it makes sure that you don't miss new episodes. And it also helps me because it increases the rankings of the show a little bit, which of course then makes it a little bit more easily found by other people who may like it just as much as you. And if you didn't like something about this episode or about the show in general, or if you have ideas or suggestions or just feedback to share, shoot me an email, mike@muscleforlife.com, muscleforlife.com, and let me know what I could do better or just what your thoughts are about maybe what you'd like to see me do in the future. I read everything myself. I'm always looking for new ideas and constructive feedback. So thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope to hear from you soon.